Blog Talk Radio.
Steve Jobs said, "Your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life."
You're listening to the Goldstein on Geld Show with financial expert Douglas Goldstein. This show is designed to give general information related to investing and finance. Neither Doug Goldstein, his guests, nor the radio station are rendering legal, tax, insurance, or specific financial advice. If you require such advice, contact a competent professional advisor. Before making any investment decisions based on what you heard during the show, please review the complete disclaimer located at www.goldsteinongeld.com. And now, here's your host, Money Maven, Doug Goldstein.
Good Money Monday. I'm your host, Doug Goldstein of the Goldstein on Geld Show. Really appreciate your joining me today. I just want to start with a conversation that I had because it was a little bit disturbing, and I think it might be relevant for some people because it's type of conversation I've had on more than one occasion, usually with women. A woman came in and she said that she was planning to get divorced maybe next year from her husband. And so that led into a big discussion about the finances, and it turned out that she knew nothing about the family financial situation. Not only that, the husband took all of the money, and he managed it in ways that she didn't know. She didn't know really what he earned or where he, and he traveled a lot, so you can make your own conclusions about what might have been going on in this marriage. But I want to talk to you about some of the issues of how to deal with a very, very dysfunctional marriage, especially in terms of money. So one of the things that this client had done, which was pretty smart, is that she did have some inheritance, and she had taken that money a long time ago and put it into a separate bank account that her husband didn't know about, and the statements all went to her family member's account, and it was handled that way. But I'd like to give you a few clues, and we'll talk about a couple now, a few ideas, and then maybe after the break I'll tell you a couple more. If things are looking bad in the marriage financially, first and foremost, try and work on the marriage. But you also have to watch out for your own interests. The number one thing you have to do is gather all of your financial records. You need to know what's going on. So there are many ways of doing that, but the first one is just try to get to the mail. Open the letters and see what's happening. For anything that's going to be private for yourself, open a post office box. Make or have a separate address where you can have stuff sent, because you are going to begin to need your own privacy in terms of setting yourself up for handling the money. And the next thing is start putting away money for legal and other professional needs that you may run across. I can't tell you, I've met with many, mostly women, who were, the family itself was fairly wealthy, but as soon as things turned south, she didn't have any access to money. So she couldn't go ahead and hire the lawyers that she needed, whereas her husband did have access to the money, and he was able to get a very, very powerful team. All right, let's talk a little bit more about that in a minute. I just want to let you know that in the first half of the show, I'll be talking to a faculty member at the Harvard Business School, Professor John Davis. And in the second half of the show, I'll be talking to Connie Deacon about communication. And she's the author of the best-selling book called Talk Less, Say More. Stay tuned.
Global investments with local wisdom.
Now let's hear from CPA Ron Zalbin with a tax tip on the Goldstein on Geld Show.
Hi, I'm Ron Zalbin, a U.S. and Israeli CPA with the firm of Abu Lafia Avital & Sharansky in Jerusalem. I previously covered the difference between being self-employed in Israel and being salaried. I frequently get asked, for a self-employed person, what type of expenses are deductible? I recently had a discussion with a potential client who was a computer programmer of what type of expenses she could deduct. I'd like to share with you our conversation. The first thing that she could deduct was her internet connection. She had a very high-speed internet connection in order to do her work for her supplier abroad, so she could deduct the expense of that. Also, the special infrastructure that she had to buy would have to be depreciated over a 3-year period. Second, her computer. That would have to also be depreciated over a 3-year period. Any supplies that she bought, for example, paper, paperclip, ink, toner cartridges, are all valid expenses. Third, any taxi rides that she needed to take in order to service her client. Fourth, she had a special telephone line in her house that was purely for business. That could be expensed. Fifth, her cell phone. Part of her cell phone is deductible, and part of it is not. Israeli tax authority recognizes that cell phones are used for personal use, so part of that cell phone use will not be deductible. Next, her bookkeeping fees, in order to do her monthly work, would be deductible. Next, any lawyer fees that she pays in order to negotiate contracts with suppliers, with customers, are deductible. Next, if she has an office in the home, a portion of the electricity and the Arnona can be deducted. Any out-of-pocket expenses that she spends in order to attract clients or to maintain clients, with some exceptions which we'll cover in another segment in the future. The most important part is that she needs to get receipts. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to email me at ron@abulafia.co.il.
Thanks so much, CPA Ron Zalbin, for today's Goldstein on Gelt Tax Tip. We were talking a minute ago about some ideas you should do if it looks like your marriage is not going in the right direction and if divorce is in the offing, things you need to do in order to prepare yourself financially. So a couple of the ideas that we spoke about were gathering all of your financial records, opening a post office box or just getting another mailing address, putting aside some money for legal and other fees that really could come up. You should also make sure you get your own checking and savings account so you can begin to have access to money and to write checks. And along the same vein is open a new credit card. Get a credit card in your name only. First of all, after a divorce, you may not have the ability to get a credit card. No one will make the offer. And you may need to have access to some of that money. There are real problems that people have, and maybe you're familiar with it, when they run up huge debts on their credit cards. So I don't want you to go in that direction. But having access to that line of credit in a time of need could be very helpful. The other thing you want to seriously consider is look at your beneficiaries on your life insurance policies, your IRAs. It's coming time now that you may want to change that, especially after the divorce, to someone else so that your ex-husband doesn't inherit your assets if, heaven forfend, you should pass away. All right, a couple of ideas. Stay tuned. In just a minute, I'll be bringing on from the Harvard Business School, John Davis, right here on the Goldstein on Gelt Show.
You're listening to the Goldstein on Gelt Show, www.goldsteinongelt.com.
Okay, we are back. I'm very happy to have on the Goldstein on Gelt Show, direct from the Harvard Business School, Professor John Davis, who teaches and researches about family businesses and family wealth. John, real pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Doug.
So just to understand a little more of the specifics of what you do, could you describe the difference between, let's say, a regular entrepreneurial startup and a family business?
Yeah, you know, the definition now, which is widely accepted in our field, is that a family business is one that is controlled through ownership by a single family, where two or more family members influence the direction and policies of the company. So an entrepreneurial company, you know, you could be an entrepreneur that, and your family technically may own it, but if no one else in your family along with you has any influence over that business, I wouldn't consider it a family company. Now, having said that, you know, about two-thirds of all the companies in almost any economy are family companies.
No kidding. Okay,
yeah.
So I guess I'm a perfect example. My day job is that I'm a financial advisor. I run sort of a niche business in Jerusalem. We deal with people who used to live in America and now they live in Israel, or generally anyone who's not living in America but wants to have a U.S. brokerage account in U.S. financial services. And my partner and co-owner, in fact, is my wife, who is the CFO and also a licensed investment advisor. So I'm just clarifying, this is what you mean by a family-run business.
Yeah, that's a good example of it. And there are plenty of couple-owned businesses, and millions of them, and also businesses that are owned by, you know, a father founder and his kids or her kids now, and or by siblings, brothers and sisters who own companies together, or cousins and later generations who own companies together.
Okay,
there
so
are family.
I'm,
go ahead.
I'm glad you brought up that exact example, which is the, you know, the father, the parents own the business, and at a certain point they then want to bring their children into the business. And there's so many stories that you hear about, you know, they say why you shouldn't work for a family-owned business because bad enough you have to answer to the father, but it's going to be much worse one day when you have to answer to his son. Is that true, or is that just kind of a myth?
No, I think there, well, I think it, there's some truth in it, because sometimes when the next generation is not capable or capable and arrogant, people don't want to work for them and would much rather work for the founder or the senior generation who they respect and get along with better. So there's some truth to that. You find these examples. But in general, what we see is that family companies have much more loyal workforces, much greater internal loyalty, much greater loyalty to suppliers and customers. And there was a recent survey done by Edelman, which is the largest public relations firm in the world, based in New York City. And they were looking at family companies all over the world. And the public trusts family companies significantly more than non-family companies.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so I see something. So now let me pick your brain here for some advice, because my oldest child is 21 and she's in school now. And at a certain point, the fact is we don't even know if it's appropriate for our four kids to ultimately enter the business. But you know, certainly we feel like for 20 years we've been building this up. And I know that this is an issue that comes up with family businesses. A, how do you know if your kids are right for it? And B, is it appropriate to bring kids into the business?
Well, it's very appropriate to bring kids into the business. You know, there, anytime you favor your kids through in employment, in passing ownership to them, it's called nepotism. And nepotism has a distinctly bad tinge to it.
Right.
But in truth, there are forms of nepotism that work out great and other forms of nepotism that work out really awfully. And so you want to, if you're going to bring your kids into the business, or if you're going to pass your business to your kids in ownership, you want to get them ready, get them prepared, because both ownership and jobs and management really require good preparation, and not everybody is suited for it. So you should have standards in your family that say, to get a job in this business, you must do X. You must complete a university degree. In some cases, I see families saying you have to have an MBA, outside work experience, et cetera, before we let you in.
Yeah, I think the outside work experience is probably a very important idea. We're talking to John Davis, a professor in the Harvard Business School, who specializes in family-run businesses, and I guess I've taken advantage of a few minutes of our conversation to talk about my own business, which is a family-owned business. And, John, I'm going to keep taking advantage of that because I have a feeling a lot of people might have questions. If you want to bring your kids in, and I got to tell you, I love my children and I trust them and I think they're brilliant, but watching other people, oftentimes, you know, you'll see that a parent is very hesitant to trust his child to do something, and often will, especially maybe even a controlling parent who is used to controlling everything because he controls the company, how can he learn to trust his children and to really turn over the reins to them?
Well, owner-operators of companies tend not to be very trusting of anybody, and they tend to over-control. Not everybody, it's not true for everybody, but I think in general that's it's a true statement. And one's own children, the control tends to go up a bit in many cases, probably most cases, because not only are you concerned about your company, but you're also concerned that your kid doesn't fail at something. And both of those are understandable feelings on for parents, but they both get in the way of development. And you must let your subordinates and especially your kids, who may eventually run this thing, have some latitude so they can succeed, fail, understand themselves better, prove themselves to others, etc.
So what would be maybe one or two techniques you would suggest as your kids are in their 20s and ready to begin to get involved in the business?
Well, number one, as I said, you need to have qualifications. And make sure not just the parents, but somebody outside the family also evaluates the children according to these qualifications. It could be an advisory board member for some companies, but maybe just a friend of the family, maybe a good professional that you work with, who you have, so you have some kind of outside benchmarking that's going on. But the second thing is, you know, you want to be able to get have very clear expectations in the next generation about what they're going to do when they come in, how fast they'll move, what jobs they'll get, what they'll get paid, how they'll, what decisions they will be involved in. Those kind, that kind of expectation setting in advance doesn't take a whole lot of time, but it's fundamental. And then when they come in, Doug, you really do need to challenge them and hold them accountable. And it's a friendly thing because you want your kids to succeed. But 90%, honest to God, it's got to be like this, maybe more, of the family businesses that I've worked with over 30 years don't do formal performance reviews with their kids.
Do they do it with their other staff members?
They're poor at it in general.
It's a hard thing to do.
It's a very hard. Where human beings are not just wired to avoid it. They're wired not to do it.
Well, I mean, you're working with someone every day, and it seems awkward. As a boss, I can tell you this. It seems awkward to call in someone we talk to all the time and say, you know, I'm going to sit you down and tell you what I think of you. And, you know, it's easy when it's good, but if there's any criticism, it's very tricky. And certainly I could hear that's difficult with kids.
Oh, completely. I get the humanness of the dilemma. But we also know that if we don't do it, we run into binds. People can end up, you know, performing for a long time in a company thinking they're doing okay or even good when they're not doing well for you at all. And that's unfair to them.
Right. And it's unfair to the other staff members as well as the clients.
Yeah,
ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do you deal with the feelings of the other staff members? In other words, the people who are not going to get promoted as quickly as your kids because they're not going to get to be the owner of the company one day.
Yeah. Well, they have to see that there's a quid pro quo here, that family members, if they're good, go faster, further faster. But in return for that, they're more committed, more capable, try harder, set a better example. That's the quid pro quo. And when people see that, they tend to see family members as not only offering stability for the future, this family ain't going to sell the business. You know, we've got longevity here, but also a sense of purpose and a sense of commitment to the culture, blah, blah, blah. It works. And that's how family businesses in general build great cultures and have more loyal employees, because that quid pro quo is in effect.
Interesting. All right. So let's leave off with the final question is, ultimately, are there financial advantages or disadvantages of setting up a family business?
Well, yes, in a number of ways. We know from research in a number of countries now over different periods of time that family companies, maybe surprisingly to all your listeners, family companies perform better. And not just by a little bit, but by significant margins on a number of financial metrics. So family companies do better, but they also take more work. Because you're not only managing the business aspect of whatever you're doing, but you've also got family involved. There are family relationships. You have to think about ownership interests and ownership concerns. And you've got to be prepared ultimately to give attention to all three of those areas, family, business, ownership. And if you're not, you usually stumble or you know, have some real problems. And sometimes it causes the business to unravel. So is it advantageous to do it? Yes. Family companies can, you know, most industry leaders, here's something. Most industry leaders are family-controlled businesses.
No kidding. Interesting. One of the things that you're describing, it sounds like that you have to do a lot of work. In other words, you're saying in order to have the family and keep everyone involved, then you have to deal with the problems of nepotism and the younger generation has to prove themselves. Maybe it just simply is that, for whatever the reason, the family companies succeed more simply because more people who care about the end result are working harder. And if we believe that there is a correlation between hard work and success, this might be a good place to see it.
Yeah, I think that's a very good, understanding of what's actually going on in these companies.
All right. John, we are just about out of time. We're talking with John Davis from the Harvard Business School. He's also the author of a book called Generation to Generation, Life Cycles of the Family Business. John, in the last few seconds, just tell us, how can people follow you and follow your work?
Well, if you go to the Harvard Business School website, you'll see an executive program that I run called Families in Business. I really encourage people to check it out. You can also get to a number of my published work and even see some videos of me. If you go to Cambridge Family Enterprise Group, my advisory firm, you can really learn about our practice with families.
Okay, we will put a link to that at the show notes of today's show at goldsteinongelt.com. John Davis, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Doug.
Earlier on in the show, I was talking about the importance of how to prepare for a potential divorce if that looks like the way you're going. And we spoke about getting more independent in terms of having your own bank accounts, having your own credit cards, changing the beneficiaries on your life insurance policies. You also want to make sure you take an inventory of all personal property so that you know what's yours, what's marital property. And there are different things that you got, let's say, before you were married that you kept separate will probably be considered separate. But any sort of items or gifts that you got together or that you gave to each other would probably be considered marital items. And another great trick, is certainly for the more valuable things, is go around the house and take some digital photographs and or videos of everything. Make sure there's a date stamp on it, so, or you can hold a newspaper in the picture, just so you have proof of what was there. Sadly, when marriages start to fall apart, sometimes you see that people will get a little bit, they get sticky fingers and stuff can disappear. So you want to prepare for that. And, of course, make sure you speak to your lawyer and don't do anything that's illegal. But prepare your own financial situation so that you are going to be safe. All right, listen, I hope you'll stay tuned. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking to Connie Deacon, who is an expert in communication. And, of course, communication is so critical in marriages, especially as it relates to money. You know, one of the things that I often joke about in my day job as a financial advisor is that although people come to me for financial advice, so much of what we talk about is really more kind of marriage advice, how to deal with each other in making these decisions. So I'm very excited to have Connie coming on the show. She's the best-selling author of Talk Less, Say More. She'll be here on the second half of the Goldstein on Gelt show. I'm your host, Doug Goldstein. I'll see you right after the break.
You're listening to Money Maven Doug Goldstein on the Goldstein on Gelt show. Stay tuned for the second half of the show right after the break.